Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So for decades, Thomas Dolby has spent his career at the intersection of music and technology. The early days of MTV brought his music to audiences worldwide. His groundbreaking videos stood out from the pack, and his huge hits have stood the test of time. His keyboard and production work put him in the studio with the likes of David Bowie, Stevie Wonder, Joni Mitchell, and he began scoring films and computer games, which eventually led him to Silicon Valley and a software startup that turned up the volume on the digital music revolution. He created the software that allowed ringtones to be played on Nokia phones around the world. Thomas's new book, The Speed of Sound, is the story of an extraordinary guy living an extraordinary life, a single-handed quest to make peace between art and the digital world. And we are thrilled that he's joining us tonight. Good evening, Thomas.
Good evening. How are you?
I am wonderful. I was just saying, absolutely loved the book and your story and your journey throughout your life. Your father and your grandfather were Cambridge professors. Your mother was also a teacher. Where did the influence of music enter your life?
Yeah, I was kind of a black sheep in the family, really. I left school early and went to work in a fruit and vegetable shop to feed my punk rock habit. So they got a bit of a kick out of that. The rest of my siblings had pretty much followed them into academia. But I think they started to take me seriously when the first time they actually heard me play and sing was on Top of the Pops, which was the biggest music TV show in the UK. Like two-thirds of the island would watch it on a good night.
And you were mentioning you skipped school a little early. At 16, you were pretty adamant about making a living as a musician. And although, of course, your parents would have wanted you to follow in their footsteps, they reluctantly said they'll help you if you needed it. And you went to see Elvis Costello perform, who we had on our show a little over a year ago. Did seeing him perform make you want to do this even more?
You know, it was an amazing time in London at the end of the 70s because everybody was talking about punk rock, but nobody was quite sure what it was. Basically, any musician that had straight trousers and short hair was considered a punk. And you can go and see in pubs and clubs the likes of Elvis Costello and The Police and The Clash. And it was a really great time socially to be in London, a real melting pot. Musically, not quite so interesting to me, but there was this underground starting to bubble up where people were getting their hands on synthesizers, which were very rare and very undependable at the time. And didn't stay in tune very well, but there was a group of us, including Cabaret Voltaire and Throbbing Gristle and so on, who would play these extraordinary sort of multimedia performances in basements for bunches of guys with anoraks and acne problems. And it was a long time before the electronic music scene really became mainstream. But when it finally did, at the beginning of the 80s, you got breakthrough hits from people like the Human League and Depeche Mode and Soft Cell and so on. And I very much consider myself part of that wave.
Well, talking about synthesizers, you wrote about taking a shortcut home one night and you saw something sticking out of a dumpster that kind of changed your life.
Well, there was a garbage strike going on in London at the time. This is in the winter of 1978. And in a back street close to where I lived in South London, there was one of the few British synthesizer manufacturers called EMS. And in a dumpster outside their workshop, I found the circuit board for a Transcendent 2000, which was a rather primitive, by today's standards, monophonic synthesizer. But I took it home and managed, with a soldering iron, to get it hooked up to my speakers and proceeded to make lots of bleeps and blips, which I recorded onto a Revox reel-to-reel tape recorder.
And then, you know, that really became, and you kind of explored that a little bit to find out what it was all about. I mean, your curiosity was peaking at this time.
Well, I've always had this irresistible urge to go into places that are sort of undiscovered, unexplored. And that's been consistent through my career. I mean, in the early days, it was synthesizers and electronics. And then it was MTV videos. And later on, it was the web and mobile phones. And I've always had this incredible magnetic attraction to areas that have not been defined, where there is no user manual and there are no mentors to show you how to do it. I love being one of the first people to dive in there and figure out ways to express myself creatively.
Sure. I mean, and your career has spoken that all the way straight through of the groundbreaking things that you have done. Fast forward a bit to 1981. You were on the verge, and you tell the story in the book, of signing your first solo recording deal with A&M, and something happened.
Well, yes. On the eve of the signing ceremony, they did a complete U-turn and decided not to sign me at all. And I was left with a rather hefty lawyer's bill. And I actually fled the UK and hitched a ride to Paris in a refrigerated chicken lorry. And I joined a school friend there who was working as a busker, a street musician in the metro subway stations. And I spent a few months cutting my teeth, sitting on my backside playing Dylan songs for Japanese tourists for a few centimes at a time.
But that kind of told you right off the bat with this deal with A&M that the record industry wasn't as fabulous as one might have hoped.
Well, the good news was they were interested in me. They were interested enough to offer me a contract, and I didn't score the first one, which is a disappointment. But, you know, I was only 20 years old, and so there was time. Out of the blue, while I was in Paris, I got a call from a certain Mick Jones.
Yeah.
I was over the moon. I thought this was Mick Jones from The Clash. But it turned out to be the other Mick Jones.
From Foreigner, of course. Yeah, yeah.
A band that I didn't know very well, and I sort of associated them with, you know, guitar and drum rock, a little bit different from what I did. But they said, no, actually, our new album, which turned out to be Foreigner 4, has got some beautiful ballads on it, and we'd love you to come to New York and see if you can add some keyboard magic. So I got to Electric Lady in New York, and I'd never really spent that much time in a recording studio, but they left me alone all night with a relief engineer, and they would come back in the morning and listen to what I'd done. And so I created this sort of very ambient intro to a song called Waiting for a Girl Like You. And when the band came in the morning, I think the bass player was that remarked, well, it's a bit like massage music, isn't it? but Mick Jones piped up and said, no, I think this would make a great intro. It's going to sound incredible on the radio. And so they left it on. And Waiting for a Girl Like You became a huge breakaway hit. And, you know, my keyboard playing was very obvious and very upfront on that and on things like Urgent and so on. And so at that point, the music industry caved and said, you know, this is a guy that has got a future.
And then in 1982, you finally got that record deal. You released The Golden Age of Wireless, which is, you know, just the name itself really tells the story of where you are today. But the hit, She Blinded Me with Science, wasn't even on the first release of this album.
It wasn't. No, I recorded it after the album came out in the UK and was very well reviewed and sold about three copies. And I was more intrigued at the time by the advent of MTV because I wasn't getting much radio play. But MTV was powerful enough in those days that you could, if you got a song in rotation, you could easily have a hit single, you know, even despite the lack of radio. Coupled with the dance clubs, the sort of crossover urban dance scene that was happening at the beginning of the 80s. And all of that added up to a big commercial hit for me.
Well, you talk about the story behind that song. And I've read this before about you. You've always been a fan of silent movies and really saw a music video as being an opportunity to make a silent movie with a soundtrack, so to speak. So you made the video for She Blinded Me with Science without even really having a song at that point.
Well, I drew the storyboard for the video.
Yeah.
I mean, people were identifying me as a sort of geeky scientist character, and that's not surprising considering, you know, A, my academic background and the little round specs, and B, the fact that, you know, most of the front men of the day were pinups like Adam Ant and Sting and Simon Le Bon and so on, and I seemed to have this sort of geeky aura. So I thought, well, if I'm going to be a geek, I have to be a cool geek, and I need a hot Japanese lab assistant and a cool vintage motorcycle and sidecar combo. And one thing led to another, and so I created the storyboard, took it into my record company, and they saw the title, She Blinded Me with Science, and they said, have we heard this song? I said, no, but I'll bring it in on Monday morning. How's that? And I basically went away for the weekend and wrote the song.
What does that song mean to you today? Is generations still find it and know it very well?
you know, if you're going to be saddled with one song that people won't stop shouting for at concerts and things, then it's not a bad one to have. It's got a great groove. It's sort of timeless in an odd kind of way. You know, it's funky and danceable, but it's definitely quite quirky and it's loaded with hooks. So, I mean, I'm very happy that it's stood the test of time and still gets used in, you know, shampoo ads and as a ringtone on Breaking Bad and things like that. And yeah. I'm very grateful that it still gets some play.
All right, more with musician and tech pioneer Thomas Dolby next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Thomas Dolby about his new book, The Speed of Sound. Well, the idea of forming bands that only used electronic equipment to make music, that was quite a novel thing in the late 70s and early 80s. I mean, that was pretty groundbreaking.
Well, it was, and it was, I wasn't the first to do it. David Bowie, who was one of my teenage heroes, you know, had gone to Berlin with Eno and made electronic pop. That was strongly influenced by Kraftwerk and all the krautrockers, and was getting in the charts with purely electronic sounding records. And so there was a precedent for it. I think the tough thing really was that there was a kind of a backlash from the corporate rock world that, you know, if it wasn't played with stringed or skinned instruments, it wasn't real music. And certainly some of my contemporaries tended to exaggerate the inherent sort of coldness and clinicism of electronic instruments and make a big deal about that sort of, you know, that alienation and that distance. But I actually went the other way. I mean, it was always my goal to make music lusher and more orchestral and more organic sounding, really, using electronics. And so I think that what I was able to do was use the commercial success of She Blinded Me with Science to get a whole generation of listeners, you know, beyond it and into the deeper cuts on my albums. And, you know, if you go on the forums and chat rooms these days, it's not She Blinded Me with Science or Hyperactive they talk about. It's songs like Screen Kiss and Airwaves and Budapest by Blimp, I Love You Goodbye. I mean, all of the more atmospheric, more personal songs are the ones that really made the strongest impression on people.
Well, and it gave you such incredible exposure as well. And again, you write in the book that, you know, 85 was a big year in so many different ways. You were asked to perform on the Grammys in a synth supergroup that included Stevie Wonder and Herbie Hancock and Howard Jones. That there must have been quite a memorable experience, being on the stage with all these other talents.
Well, it was incredibly flattering, obviously, being paired with those guys. I think it's sort of a breakthrough moment, really, where the Grammys wanted to sort of announce that electronic music was here to stay and had credibility and legitimacy. And in some ways, you know, 1985 was also the sort of watershed year where electronics started to get cool and get merged in with sort of indie rock. You know, you had people like New Order, who in a way were a prototypical, you know, Joy Division had been a prototypical guitar-driven indie band, going over to electronics and doing stuff like Blue Monday. You got towards the end of the 80s, bands like Depeche Mode, who could fill stadiums, you know, using only synths. And then obviously, you know, more recently we've had the EDM movement and so on, and you know, the whole DJ culture came about, you know, from that period. So it was really a pivotal moment.
Well, and you were backing David Bowie in Live Aid as well. I have to imagine that was a bit overwhelming, a bit nerve-wracking.
Well, it was a transcendental experience. We had very little time to rehearse with David because he was busy shooting a film called Labyrinth during the day. And we got three evenings of rehearsal with him, during which time he kept changing his mind about what songs to do. And the eventual set list that he came up with for Live Aid, he only settled on the last day. And when we walked on stage at Wembley in front of 100,000 people and, you know, a million more on TV, we'd never actually played the four songs back to back. And it was up to me to open the set with the piano intro to TBC 1-5, which is a sort of like a honky-tonk style that is not exactly my forte.
Right.
So, yeah, it was nerve-wracking, but, you know, it was so great to be backing, you know, a guy that I'd grown up adoring, and, you know, all of the band were his disciples, really, and he was wonderful from start to finish, really sort of exuded, you know, light. He was just like an angel.
Really. Legend, absolutely. It's also the year you came out with Astronauts and Heretics. Close But No Cigar is a personal favorite, and it included Eddie Van Halen. What was that experience like, working with Eddie?
Sweet guy, but more Spinal Tap than Spinal Tap itself. In fact, usually with a musician anywhere in the world, you can break the ice by quoting from Spinal Tap. But when I quoted a Spinal Tap quip to Eddie, he looked pretty grim and said, "We didn't like that movie, man. Yeah. Like somebody followed us around with a camera and put it up on the screen and everybody fell over laughing."
Yeah, he wasn't fond of that movie whatsoever.
Not, but he played beautifully on my album, and I was very fortunate because, you know, the band always had a pretty tight grip on Eddie, and you know, aside from Michael Jackson's Thriller album, it's pretty unusual to find Eddie collaborating with anybody else.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And then a few more groundbreaking albums, and you decided to step away from music itself, and you launched a company called Headspace and developed some very cool things.
Yeah, well, at the end of the 80s, the cracks were starting to show in the beginning of in the music business. I mean, the first digital downloads were happening, and it was clear to me that eventually the record companies would lose their sort of stranglehold on the business, because I was making music on my computer. Most of my fans had the same machine, and we're now all connected via the internet. So why go through the whole cost of pressing plants and fleets of trucks and so on? And it took rather longer than I expected, but it you know, obviously eventually that's the way the music industry went. And frankly, I think today it's a much better deal for both musicians and fans, you know, to be able to get so much music and have such a wide, eclectic range of tastes on your playlist, and get, you know, easy access to music the moment it comes out. And for musicians, you can get paid almost instantaneously and keep the lion's share of the profits. Now, obviously, the downside is there's 10,000 other guys trying to occupy the same space. So, you know, the challenge really is rising above the radar and getting noticed. But I think it's a much fairer system than it was back in the days when a handful of record companies basically dictated what the public got to hear.
But you have this extraordinary talent, and you just kind of redirected it into something else. Your company became Beatnik. It developed software that changed the face of cell phones. I don't think a lot of people know that.
Well, I don't think they do, although it's sure to end up on the back of a Trivial Pursuit card one day, you know, right after the one about how Mike Nesmith of the Monkees, you know, was the son of the woman that invented liquid paper.
Right. Mike Nesmith. Exactly.
But, yeah, so the story of it was that basically, you know, through the 90s, my company, Headspace, released this product called Beatnik, which we eventually changed our name to, which was a software synthesizer designed to do music on the web. And we had millions of users and lots of downloads and big press releases and, you know, and so on. But we made absolutely zero revenue until one single deal changed it all for us, and that was with Nokia phones. And at the end of the 90s, they were looking for a way to do polyphonic ringtones on their phones. And they found that Beatnik was the most efficient software synthesizer in the world. And so they worked with us to integrate it into their phones. And since 1999, every Nokia phone has shipped with the Beatnik synthesizer, doing the sound, basically doing the voice, the alarms, the beep, bleeps and blips, and also the ringtones. And as history has recorded, the ringtone phenomenon, you know, in the 2000s was absolutely off the charts and, you know, at one point got close to equaling the rest of the music business put together, which is a very strange phenomenon. But during that time, Beatnik was actually embedded in about two-thirds of the world's mobile phones.
Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. Now, as an artist who grew up in the world of record albums and traditional distribution, how do you feel about the modern streaming universe and the way people now access their music, Thomas?
Well, you know, it's like when I get a glance at people's playlists, I'm just thrilled that they have such an open mind. I mean, when I was when I was a teenager, it wasn't cool to have, you know, Pink Floyd and ABBA next to each other in your record collection. It was a lot more tribal. You were sort of forced to pick sides. And I think these days people are a lot more open-minded. And the other thing is that, you know, recording standards have improved all around the world. So it's become a much more globalized phenomenon. You could hear music from any of the continents alongside each other. So I actually think it's a great time for music. I think there are a lot of business issues to be sorted out because, as I'm sure you've heard, we get paid minuscule amounts right. per play on, you know, Spotify and YouTube and things like that. And I'm not saying that we have a God-given right to be multimillionaires, but, you know, a lot of musicians are making something these days from the music that they sell, but it's a little bit slanted at the moment in favor of the tech companies, and that has to be put right so that musicians can make Absolutely. A decent living from something other than their live shows.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And really, you know, a multimedia artist whose groundbreaking work fused music and computer technology and video, you are truly a pioneer.
Well, thank you. I mean, I don't consider myself a pioneer really, but I just consider myself an early adopter and somebody with the imagination to think outside the box and take a new technology or a new technique or a new business situation and get creative with it. Most of my career, I didn't really have a mentor. There was nobody to point me in the right direction. I had to sort of figure it out by trial and error. And I've got to a stage in my life now where I feel that I should pass on some of that experience and wisdom to the younger generation. So I've recently taken up a post as professor of the arts at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
Very cool.
Where I'm teaching film music to a new generation of students.
Incredible.
And really enjoying it. And I kind of wish that when I was starting out, I had somebody like me to point me in the right direction.
And now you're providing that to others, which is very cool.
Yeah.
Which is very cool. Well, we only touched upon some of the highlights of the new book, The Fast-Paced, Fun, and Insightful, The Speed of Sound, available wherever books are sold. And for more on Thomas, you can follow him on thomasdolby.com. What a pleasure spending some time with you tonight, Thomas.
Been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much as well. All right, it's 720 WGN.